Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, Ilona Thompson, Palate Exposure. I'm here today with Ian White, who is a vintner. As we talked about, everything to everybody, and a man of all trades, a musician also that has permeated our conversations in the past, integral part of who he is, but also a winemaker, probably a babysitter,
absolutely,
and all those good things, and extremely interesting backstory, which is why I intend to not skip till the end, because I'm looking at a lineup of wines and salivating. But we're gonna be patient, and we're gonna start with your background, Ian.
Absolutely.
Tell us where you were born, where you went to school, all the good factual data.
I will. So, Ian Devereaux White. The winery is Smith Devereaux.
Yeah.
And I went to UC Santa Barbara, and that was a wonderful experience. It's really where I started writing, and my career began with writing and not with wine. And so I was writing for Lonely Planet Travel Guides. And after writing for Lonely Planet, the president of Lonely Planet, who was on a long tour with me in a 32-foot RV through 28 states, took over a magazine in San Francisco. That magazine was called 7x7, and they didn't have anyone writing about wine. At that time, I had finished writing for Lonely Planet, and the reason is it's working for Lonely Planet's kind of like going on a million first dates and never getting to kiss the girl. Because by the time you get to know a town, you got to move on to the next spot. You write it down and you swear you're going to go back, but you don't. And so I had done enough of that. I'd seen enough. It was a wonderful experience. So I wanted to move on. So he said, you know what? Why don't you write? Well, I mean, you're going up to Napa all the time. We're both living in the Bay Area. Why don't you head up there and write about the wineries, write about the experiences for 7x7. I'll give you a stipend. And at the same time, I had started dating Ariana, who is now my wife. So I was up here all the time. And I started writing. I started writing best views, most dog-friendly wineries, and right time, right place kind of situation. And suddenly there were all these people responding to what I wrote, comments all over the place, being reposted, and people coming up and buying wines and visiting all of these wineries. And so I was blessed in that I was right off the bat able to really do a service for the valley and for the people of the valley without asking for anything in return. And so as I traveled and wrote about Napa Valley, about Sonoma, about the people and places, and more than anything, the experiences, and also wine pairings and things like that, I became, you know, a part of the community really quickly, because where I went, good things happened. People would use the driving service I wrote about. They'd go to Villadera because they heard the views were amazing, or Silverado Trail. And so that was how I was exposed to the industry. And I continued. I wrote for Edible, I wrote for Wine Enthusiast, and eventually, and am currently still, the wine director for San Francisco Magazine. And I was interviewing someone at the tasting room where you're sitting now, or actually it was two doors down at John Anthony Tasting Room, and he said, so you're a wine writer? And I said, well, I'm a writer. He said, how long have you been writing? I said, well, geez, I guess 12 years. He said, man, you've just been telling other people's stories for 12 years?
Ouch.
Yeah, I was like, and you, sir, are a bit of a jerk. But it got me thinking. And so I went back to a shared office I had with John Truchard, and it was really his office, and I had a space there. And I said, you know, you're always talking about, you know, I hear you on the phone, you're always selling these grapes, and I know you farm this vineyard right in front of my house. I'm going to buy those grapes, and I'm going to make a wine. And he said, you are going to lose your shirt. This is a terrible idea. I was like, oh, this is just not my day. Oh, man. And then he said, I have a better idea for you. I am sick of selling these grapes, and we have all these wonderful grapes that I farm. Why don't we start a wine company? Why don't we start a winery, and we can get long-term leases on these vineyards. We'll do everything from farm to bottle, and we'll make a winery together. That way you're not just struggling through one vineyard or one wine at a time. Let's do this. Let's build this. And I jumped at the opportunity, and that began the company that is now Smith Devereaux. We had another name, and I won't go into that because that name is now defunct, but it included John. And so that was the beginning of the transition for me from writing about wine as the majority of what I did to actually participating in the making of wine.
So which year was that you started writing for Lonely Planet?
That would have been 2002, I think? 2003?
Wow, so it's pre-blogosphere proliferation and the influencer onslaught.
It was MySpace. Yeah, that was when everybody was still on MySpace. So no, it was. Blogging was sort of not something people were doing. It was certainly, when I was writing for Lonely Planet, it was the thorn tree. And the thorn tree was a very exciting thing because everyone traveling all over the world would post where their dentist is, or they had a great dental experience in Thailand, and people would then access that and won all these awards because it was people who were having the experiences writing. It wasn't just those of us who wrote for Lonely Planet writing about our experiences, you know, we're of the experience. We're now writing from what we've done for people who are going to do it. But now it was other people contributing to the thorn tree who were having those unusual experiences in different countries. And so it did lead quickly in that time after Lonely Planet into things like 7x7, where it was everyone was getting their information online, and 7x7 was was the source of information for San Francisco at that time, especially for the people who were millennials and slightly older than that. So I was very lucky in terms of the time frame that I was asked to do that, because there wasn't a lot of competition. I was one of those names that was out there writing online and actually getting reads. Not, I don't think, because of what I wrote or the way that I wrote, but rather because of the platform for which I wrote. 7x7 was an amazing, amazing funnel of information to the people of San Francisco who were wanting to take action on what they did, on what they read, rather. And so, you know, it was the right place at the right time.
If anybody's listening who is a journalistic profession or even a blogger, I think they're deeply jealous right now because that space is so saturated. You have made the most of it, which is pretty darn cool. Where were you born?
I was born in Los Angeles,
okay.
In Bel Air at Cedar Sinai Hospital. It used to be a joke. I was the Fresh Prince of Bel Air, which ironically, or perhaps not ironically, but rather coincidentally, is where my wife, Ariana, was born a few months later.
I thought that.
Yeah, and both of us ended up in the Bay Area together. And so, it's funny that we were born in the same hospital, in the same town, with families that lived in L.A. And I grew up reluctantly coming to Napa Valley. My parents were members at Pine Ridge. They were members at... where was it? Chateau Montelena. And so they'd bring me up here. And I remember at one point telling my mom, we were driving in the car, and I was bored as can be. I said, you know what? One of these days, I'm going to live up here. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to tear some of these vineyards out and bring up... I'm going to have horses. There are no horses up here. We should ride horses and get rid of all these vineyards.
Oh, that's too funny.
Yeah, financially speaking, that would have been a huge mistake. And there are some horses around here, but can you imagine? Yeah, I'm just going to buy a vineyard in Napa Valley and tear it all down and raise
horses. That's a very interesting thought process.
Yeah.
So you came here kind of against your will.
Very much so.
And then how did you wind up writing for Lonely Planet? Where was that transition?
Luck and nepotism, to be perfectly honest with you.
Okay.
I had been doing quite a bit of writing for the newspaper in Santa Barbara. I was an English major and had...
very practical.
I had done very well in that particular sphere. And I was bartending, I was doing a million other things in Santa Barbara, just trying to figure out who I was. And I was also getting out of a 6-year relationship and I needed an escape. Lonely Planet was looking for a driver for their 32-foot RV on the Everywhere You Are road trip, which was the first of the major road trips where you stickered up a vehicle and drove it across as a promotional tour. Now, even Silver Oak did that with their water tower from their...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, and so it's become a very popular thing. But then it was very custom. And so I applied for the job where my stepdad worked. He was working at Lonely Planet. And so I applied for the job. I had to learn to drive a 32-foot RV, so a lot of practicing. That's a fairly large vehicle. And I did that knowing that I was going to be trying to squeeze some of my writing into the project. So I submitted a bunch of articles that I wrote ahead of time and about places that I had traveled to, including Yuba City, because I was up there a lot. And the president of Lonely Planet, Todd Sakewich, who later on is the one who brought me to 7x7, said, "This is really good. How would you feel about writing something online about this tour? Every day, write something internal so that everyone in Lonely Planet, in the London office, the Paris office, and in the Oakland office can see what's going on in this tour, and then we can also share the link for all of the bookstores that we're visiting." Because the idea was, at that time, Lonely Planet was being spread widely across Barnes & Noble, Borders, and the large chains, and we wanted to show them that we also still cared about all the independent bookstores. And so the tour was of independent bookstores in 28 states on a 32-foot RV. And so as I went to those states, and then I went to those bookstores, we took photos, I posted them online, and he asked me to write these blogs, which at that time, we didn't call it a blog, they were online articles. And so I wrote these online articles for Lonely Planet that were first internal, and then they went, I suppose, they started to be read and got a lot of exposure outside of the company. People looking at the photos from Brown University, and we were throwing books out of the vehicle. We made the really wise decision to chase down a couple of tornadoes in one state in an article called Tornado Chasers. And what's amazing is they said, stay in your hotel. We didn't. We got in our RV and we chased the tornadoes and we saw them and I wrote about it and we ended up at a bar hiding as the sky turned red and the rain turned upside down and our hotel was demolished. The hotel to the ground, pretty much. That is an exaggeration, but the pool area was to the ground, and the hotel was damaged severely. And here we were, safe in this bar with our RV, blocks away, really, only or miles, rather. So our decision to be reckless saved us probably the rest of our trip, because that parking lot was destroyed, and that's where our RV would have been. So
there's been some drama. I guess when you're in the media profession, apparently real dramatic things happen, as opposed to the ones that we like to make up.
Yes, absolutely. We're not just embellishing. It's not all fake news. There are crazy things that happen. Wonderful people, wonderful rides. You never know. It is an absolute blessing to be able to share that with people and to have a voice. For me, I was the voice for San Francisco Magazine during the fires, because I woke up in the middle of the fire and it was just everywhere around us. So I grabbed my kid and my wife, and she went to her winery. Her family is a winery as well that they started in 83 rather. And I dropped my kid off and I came back and I spent my time in that world, in that fire. And so I was able to be the voice of San Francisco Magazine, both online as it was occurring and later in print. And it's an amazing thing to be able to be the voice of, I was also the earthquake, to be able to share these tragedies and these stories, and to be able to do it from a voice that is a part of the story, not telling someone else's.
This is definitely a very dark chapter in Napa history, and Sonoma, of course.
I think Sonoma hasn't been affected. No, absolutely.
I was there at the time as well, so I can completely... I mean, there's no right words to ever say, and it's not so much about the belongings, but you kind of lost our innocence.
Yes.
In some ways.
I
am so glad that you were there to cover it, and people needed to channel emotions. And I think, as a wordsmith, this is some way it's cathartic.
Yeah.
And I think other people relating to that, I think that's wonderful that you've done that.
Yeah. The world needs storytellers. The world needs people who are willing to share. Yes.
Good ones.
There are so many voices out there that aren't. I would also suggest that you got some of our charismatic, full, sparkling rosé. I know we haven't gotten into that yet, but I would hate to see it go flat while we're sitting here. So please enjoy that.
I'm remiss. No, thank you. You clearly are a very driven individual. You take the opportunity and you seize it, you make the most of it. I want to know where that spirit came from. Tell me a bit about your family.
My mom was a chef, so she opened a restaurant called Butterfields, and it was right down the street from Latoque. So she and Ken Frank, and for those listening, Latoque is a restaurant now in Napa Valley.
Yes.
So another coincidence. And so she and Ken Frank shared a lot of business and a lot of customers down there in Hollywood, and this is where when I was born. So originally, as I was growing up, I was in the restaurant world and in the culinary world. My mom still is. I was part of the beginning of California's Artisan Cheese Festival, and was one of the marketing chairs for the first 7 years of that festival.
I think I went to that festival once, and I couldn't look at the cheese for months after that. Not in a bad way, but there's so many varieties.
Oh my! I ate so much cheese during that period of my life. But so culinary world. My background with my mom was very culinary. Always helping her in the kitchen. She has moved my grandmother's stove, I think, to 4 different homes because she loves it so much. And aww. I used that stove actually just the other day making myself some eggs. It's or oven rather, whatever it may be. But it's a beautiful thing. And so growing up in that culinary world, immediately I was immersed in that. And the importance of food and local cooking and local sourcing, all of those things have been a big part of my life. My dad was in advertising, a storyteller, and so he did a campaign early on called Everything Goes With Eggs that won all of these awards, and he has this beautiful, beautiful different campaigns. He worked with the United Way, the American Cancer Society. He did a campaign with George Foreman, Real Man Get It Checked, and another cancer campaign that he did with Robin Williams. And so growing up, I was exposed to these celebrities, but I was exposed to them in a way where they were supporting a cause, they were fighting cancer, they were doing things like that. So I had a mom who was in the culinary world, a dad who was a storyteller and in the visual arts and a writer. And so my background was in both of those, but they were both taking action. My mom was all about buying local things, even when it was really hard, but she didn't stop at that. She found a way to do it. And my dad, the same way, telling stories for Great America, you know, he knew that I loved An American Tale and Fightful, and he thought, if he speaks to my son, I'm going to get that kid to do an advertisement for Great America, because he's going to connect with other kids. That voice of Fightful, that little mouse, if you remember the story, will connect with kids. And so he went after it, and I ended up hanging out with that kid, and he became friends with that dad. Later on, we loved the movie Clueless, and he said, I've got to get Alicia Silverstone into one of my ads, because she is connecting with people in a way that nobody else is through this movie Clueless, and through this age of shopping, and yet also of kindness and development and exploration. And so he went after it, and he found Monty Silverstone, who was living in Marin and putting on plays. And man, I think we must have seen Oliver 11 times before my dad finally met Monty and was able to develop a relationship and say, I have to tell you, I've loved these plays. I'm here because I want to talk to you about your daughter. And ultimately, Alicia never was in an advertisement. My dad did develop a wonderful friendship with Monty. I ran into Alicia, actually, not long ago at a restaurant. I said, our dads were friends. And she's like, no kidding, what was your dad's name? And so, you know, while not always a success in the things he tried, nor was my mom, they always went after it. They saw an idea. They saw something that was important to them. And they did everything they could to make it happen. And they tried to bring in a charitable aspect. And so, you know, my upbringing, I saw all of that, and I think that I owe a lot to not just their successes, but also their failures, because I have had far more failures than I have had successes in my life recently as well. And, you know, it's such an amazing experience to be able to fail and then learn from it and find a way to succeed. And even if you don't succeed in that same way, or even in that same industry, to be able to take that lesson and bring it to something else. And that's what my parents brought to me, I think, more than anything, that and hopefully a sense of humility.
Well, between those two powerful examples, you really didn't have a choice other than, you know, those are really extraordinary. And when both parents are so driven in their own way, and before it became populist rhetoric, the whole farm to table, now everybody's farm to fork or something.
I know, something.
And the fact that he actually was so creative, you know, in how he sought those relationships and connections and so driven.
Yeah.
No wonder you are where you are. Because clearly, when the opportunity presents itself, it's up to us what to do with it.
Yeah.
And some of us is just exceptionally well positioned to get every morsel out of it.
Yeah, you can be at the right time, you can be the right place, but if you don't have the aptitude, if you don't have the desire and the will to chase it, then it won't happen. I would like to say also that my stepfather, Gary, was in the publishing industry.
Oh.
And so I was surrounded by literature. He's got an amazing bookshelf. He got me into collecting first editions. He had a program every summer that he instituted for our family where we would read and we'd report on the books that we read. And then depending on how many books we read over the summer, we would go to Tower Books and Records and be able to buy music and more books for ourselves. And so he instituted a program of reading and development that was wonderful and absolutely instrumental. And he was also very driven in his publishing career, and learning the value of books and writing really came from him. And also my aunt, who is a teacher, and every year I would spend weeks or days in her classroom watching her teach and learn and be able to absorb what she was doing in that classroom and see it rather than I usually did as an elementary school student, which is as a nightmare being stuck in this classroom. I was able to see it from a different perspective through the eyes of a teacher and being able to share and change lives. Even at an early age, I was like, what she does is really cool. I think maybe I want to be a teacher. And they were among the people who were also very instrumental in my life, in addition to my parents, who were go-getters and eye-openers for me.
Well, that certainly is very instructive, because you are very blessed in terms of who you're surrounded by. They're all such great influencers. And you mentioned, you know, how curious you were and how, you know, you were really a learner very early on. Some people are lifelong learners, but it starts in the very beginning when we have those examples. We also attach to that mindset. And clearly, pretty creative thinker, the whole horse comet. But you also mentioned humility, and that probably has to do with, again, being raised in an environment where charitable causes were very important. That was also an element of what you experienced and absorbed.
Yeah.
So even, I think, for those that not necessarily are lucky enough to be in those circumstances, are really important values. You know, if you have a curious mind.
Yeah.
And you're willing to just tough it out, you're willing to go after it and, you know, roll with the punches and not give up. I think those are really important things to know.
You have to stick with it. Sometimes to a detriment, though. If I don't know the answer to something, I find myself immediately reaching for my phone and disconnecting from what I'm doing. I'm on my phone. I'm looking up a word. I'm looking up, you know, it's like, yeah. Wait, what does axiom mean exactly? Did I use that correctly? Or, you know, even Ibex, which is a wine that you'll be trying soon. You know, it's like, is it Ibex or Ibex? And are they local? I hear they're in Colorado. It's, oh, wait, no, they're from the Grand Paradiso. It's like, can we use this name? And so I just cannot stop myself from grabbing my phone and looking. It's something I'm working on because, you know, it's so important in this age where everything's at our fingertips. It's so important to be present. And you are as inquisitive as one might be, and as much as you may want the answer to something, it's so important to be able to wait and to be able to continue the conversation you're in and not stop everything so that you can find the answer that you desire. And at some level, it's the opposite of humility, right? The hubris to say, everyone stop while I get the answer that I need. And that's something that I'm working on, one of the many things that I'm constantly working on.
Do you remember that episode, Sex and the City, the ADD guy? I think that's...
Yeah, that would, yes, I do know, and that would, yes.
So I think our whole society kind of starting to resemble that.
Yes, absolutely.
When we can't switch between tasks, we just like move right into it.
Yeah, no patience, the phone's up, it's a whole thing. Yes. It's quite scary.
Yes.
It is.
So it's a salient point that you made. So fast forward after your fantastic, what it sounds like, very rewarding writing career, mm-hmm. You find yourself in a partnership mm-hmm. with a vintner that's quite renowned, that comes from a generational background.
Correct, yes.
Has to be a little intimidating.
No? Yes, absolutely it is. It's also inspiring. Mm-hmm. And I'd say it's more inspiring than intimidating, because when I first met John, he only had two employees. And he had a small office with extra space. Mm. And he was kind enough to invite me into that space. And watching him grow from a point where... you know, he was barely making it to a point where he is now one of the most successful vintners in the country, maybe world. It's been an amazing journey to be a part of that. A million cases of butter he's making. There wasn't even a Jam Cellars when I first met him. So I've been able to watch that journey from the outside. I'd like to think that at some level I've been a part of that journey as well. And it's inspiring, it's intimidating, it's awe-inspiring as well. It's so cool to see what he's done and what's happened with that brand. Some of it luck, a lot of it skill, a lot of it brilliance. But yes, I feel like this word blessed keeps coming up, but to be, you know, a partner of his. And then, you know, as we started our partnership, I was sort of running the company, but he was really very much a partner, and has his success skyrocketed. He was unable to continue to be that level of partner, still farming all the grapes, or most of the grapes rather. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you know, we got to bring somebody else in. You're working alone too much. I obviously want to maintain my ownership of this company, and mm-hmm. I want to keep Smith Devereaux growing, and mm-hmm. But we need somebody else. And at that point, it wasn't Smith Devereaux, but that's when we found Steve Smith. And he had spent 17 years in the music industry. As you mentioned at the beginning, I've been a musician my entire life. And suddenly we had this melding of John's vineyard experience, my wine writing, and then somebody from the music industry that also had a great appreciation and knowledge of food and wine, all three of us together. But your question was about John. And yes, he's just so kind and so open and so smart that while it is intimidating, it really, at the end of the day, he doesn't allow himself to be intimidating because he's so open and so kind. And it's a wonderful thing to have him in my life as a friend, as you know, our family spend time together, and as an inspiration and business partner.
Wow. Starting to consider rubbing you for good luck. You just come across this phenomenal opportunity just so spontaneously. And that's great, because like I said, the other piece is that you grasp it and you just really make something special and make it your own in many ways. So I caught John's career more on the tail, and I didn't realize there was a million cases of butter, but I knew that it was a formidable amount of wine.
Yes.
And to what you've watched him grow.
Yes.
So now I'm quite curious to what you attribute such success and being able to scale on that level. How did it all happen?
You know, there is always going to be an element of luck.
Yes.
And being at the right place at the right time. And that certainly was the case. He had a very creative, fun, playful, vibrant brand, available at a time where the wine industry was switching from being fairly snooty and stodgy to a time where it was being more playful and intoxicating and fun and about celebration. Yeah. And so he had the right wine at the right time for that transition, when wine was starting to be drinking by everyone in all different walks of life. And here was butter and jam with these playful, fun labels, but high quality wines. And so there was that risk taking. He took massive risks. I don't want to divulge too much about his personal experience, but he, you know, he was on the edge. He walked the tightrope of success and failure in order to get to where he was. There wasn't a ton of money. His family wasn't supporting him. He walked away from his family's business so that he could do this on his own. He was a farmer first, and he supported his wineries with his farm company, which is called Farm. Back then it was called Vineworks, but it's called Farm Napa Valley now. And so he supported these endeavors. He and his wife did everything they could to make it survive, including work themselves to the bone. They sent every invoice. They did everything, and they risked everything down to their home to make this work. And so there were times and nights and days, and even when I saw him, even though he wore a big smile, that I knew that he was on the edge. Like, how are we going to do this? How are we going to make this work? Is this the right distributor? Trying to do everything himself. And so I think that being willing to take those risks, being in the right place, being at the right time, the element of luck, but also being a genuinely good person. He was kind, and he is kind, and he's giving, and he does things for the right reasons. He can be myopic sometimes. It's like, hey, dude, back over here. That decision you just made, you're going to create waves, and it's going to wash this whole thing away. And he's like, oh my goodness, I did not thank you for bringing that up. Mm-hmm. And he will realize that the waves he's creating are going to have an impact or a negative impact. It'll stop, even if it is obviously going to have a profoundly positive impact for his business. He will stop if it's going to have even a small negative impact, often for others. And I think that that kindness and people seeing that, you want people like that to succeed. You want people who are kind and giving and thoughtful and generous to succeed. Right place, right time, right brand, and right person.
Wow. What that all sounds, again, fantastic, because when people become successful, I'm not saying success changes them, but there's different dynamics. And the fact that he retained that spirit, and the fact that he is exactly what you described, and your partners with him.
Yeah.
And I think there's, it's not just a halo effect at all. It really is more about surround yourself with somebody that you want to be around.
Yeah.
People that are quality.
Yes.
And that's a big part of how I define success.
Yeah. It's something I'm really working on. I find myself often being hard on myself, because here in Napa Valley, there's so many successful people and so many beautiful cars and expensive homes and all these other wonderful things. And I find myself saying, what have I done wrong that I don't have those? Why is it that my business partner is so successful and all these people that I spend time with have, you know, endless amounts of money and time and freedom and all these other things that I thought for so long that I really wanted? And then I realized that I truly love this pursuit, and it's not as though I'm not chasing success. But what I realized is that, for me, at least, and something that I guess I'm still working on, is that success can only be found within, from within. And so, while my company, we only make 6,000 cases of wine, and you've been very kind about my writing when I've been able to do, but I haven't written a book, and I only make 6,000 cases of wine, and I'm barely paying myself at this point, because we're putting everything back into the company. But it's a beautiful thing to have my name on the bottle. The whole Devereaux family, they're all wine club members, and they send me photos. We have this, you know, we have this sense of community and a sense of self and identity and authenticity is so big for me. And so I found success in those ways, and I do hope that all of that, and hopefully what I do at a philanthropic level, will also translate into the kind of success John has seen. But, you know, I'm struggling just like everybody else, and I'm enjoying the struggle, and I'm enjoying the chase.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.